This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
This holiday, BMW has reunited three members of the family at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. The Agile X3, engineered for any adventure. The plug-in hybrid X5, commanding the streets with unmatched presence. And the all-electric i4, charging into the future with impeccable performance. Hurry in to find what powers your journey at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
When it comes to hiring, don't search for a great talent, match with them. Thanks to Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find qualified candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Just go to Indeed.com/listen right now. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility. Go to Indeed.com/listen and tell them you heard about them from this podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
12:03, Thursday afternoon, December 12th. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us on the Noon Business Hour. I'm Rob Hart. Gen Z making going to the mall cool again. We'll cover that in our next segment. But first, inflation and jobs data highlight today's economic file. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Bob Bruska, Chief Economist, Fact and Opinion Economics in New York. Bob, thank you for joining us today. The Producer Price Index, that's what wholesalers are paying for their goods that they will pass along to you, the consumer, eventually. 0.4%, the increase for November. That's higher than the consensus estimate, but the core figure came in right in line with expectations. So what does that mean for the fight against inflation? And more importantly, what does that mean for the Fed when they meet next week?
Well, I'm not sure it means much for the Fed. The Fed seems to already have made up its mind. And although the Fed tells us that it doesn't have a predetermined path, and it also tells us it's data dependent, I look at this a little bit differently. I think the Fed basically has a path that is predetermined unless the data do something ugly and keep them from staying on that path. The Fed thinks that interest rates are too high. The Fed thinks that it needs to cut these rates. And the Fed has been willing to tolerate excessive inflation and even kind of nasty monthly numbers to keep cutting rates. And I frankly don't understand that. They've missed their inflation target for 44 months in a row. And the unemployment rate is moving up a little bit, but it's still below where economists think is full employment. And the Fed is focused more on cutting interest rates. We have a president coming in who's going to have an expansive fiscal policy. This doesn't seem like where you want monetary policy now, but that's what we're doing. And we do have inflation. It's not falling.
Now, when we talk about some of the things driving this report, if you want to take the rosy view of some of these figures, can you say it's entirely, can you blame this entirely on egg prices and bird flu?
Well, you can hatch that idea, but I'm not quite sure that it's going to go anywhere. I don't think it will fly. The inflation in the report is just too widespread. You know, the core inflation rate, which takes out all the food and energy stuff, still has inflation up, 3.5% year over year. Now, the Fed doesn't target the PPI. It targets the PCE deflator, which is the lower of the two between the consumer price and the PCE. And even that one's been over target for 44 months and running. So this is really not good. And the Fed seems to be content to say they're going to get there, even though they're still not there. I thought the target was a target the Fed was supposed to hit rather than a target it was supposed to aspire to. But then I'm just an economist.
Well, we also have another figure about jobless claims ticking up that from up by 17,000 from the prior period. What can we make of that, or is that just kind of the ebbs and flows of the job market as we approach the end of the year?
Well, yeah, it's somewhere between the ebbs and flows and something to be worried about. 242,000 up from 225,000 and 215,000 the week before that. So, I mean, classically, these are all extremely low numbers. You know, we used to think of jobless claims as being sort of normal when they were at 300,000. We haven't seen a number like that in a really long time. So we're not seeing a lot of jobless claims. They have moved up, but we're in the post-Thanksgiving, pre-Christmas period. And during this period, you always have a little bit more fluctuation in these numbers. So, you know, 1 month, 1 week's increase, that wouldn't make a lot of. If it goes up here and stays here, then maybe it's telling us something. But this has been a very strong job market. The insured unemployment rate picked up very briefly to 1.3%. It's back down to 1.2%. It lags by a week. But this is a very low insured unemployment rate. And so I wouldn't make too much of this. But like everything, you know, it moved. You want to look at it. It could be an early signal. Not by itself, though.
Bob Bruska, Chief Economist, Fact and Opinion Economics in New York. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up, let's all go to the mall. Gen Z driving the comeback of the shopping center.
A deposit for your future. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Malls are making a comeback, and Generation Z is one of the key drivers. Joining us with the details is Jennifer Waters, Chicago-based business reporter. Jennifer, thank you for joining us today. And if there's one lesson you should learn if you listen to the Noon Business Hour, is that nothing is ever really, truly dead. Some things may lay fallow for a little while, but eventually another generation of consumers discovers something, whether it's movie theaters or the shopping mall, and the shopping mall appears to be having its day in the sun.
Yep, that's right, Rob. And it's back to the old adage of what's old is new again. And that's exactly what we're seeing here. And this is being driven, as you mentioned, by Gen Z consumers, and who are shopping in malls as much as their boomer grandparents once did. And we're just seeing kind of a resurgence of that. And here's part of the reason. The whole retail landscape has changed dramatically. Certainly since COVID, part of it was beginning to change beforehand, where you were adding more, more entertainment type, or even medical offices and such in malls. But now and then restaurants and stuff, we have the mall be that meeting place again. And now that we have so many digital native retailers turning to brick and mortar, we're seeing more exciting retailers, or new, you know, which is sometimes exciting, go into the malls. And that's just what's making them more, you know, places where people want to be. Go ahead.
I was going to say, Jennifer, I feel like this dovetails very nicely with the discussion we had about the resurgence of Chi-Chi's and the redesign of Pizza Hut, and just this playing into this desire to not only be together with other people. We have so many opportunities to connect with people virtually, but the opportunities to connect with people in real life, and also for a relatively, you know, a pittance, a small amount of money, that seems to be a very valuable commodity today.
Yes, exactly. And I think that, and that's why we're looking at these malls as being community centers of sorts, where people are out there meeting each other and hanging out, and which, you know, was really an 80s thing and 70s and certainly into the 90s. But, you know, the e-commerce has kind of dried some of that up. Certainly COVID had a big impact on all that, too. But then, you know, think about everything that has come back since COVID and how people want to be with people again. You know, go figure that. But it's, you know, and we see this, too, in malls where this transformation of the mall itself is. You see it here in Chicago. You see it at Old Orchard. You see it at Deerfield, you see it out at Oakbrook Court, where they're changing the malls and adding a lot of housing and stuff, which in the real estate world means critical mass, i.e. people, and they're adding all that there. And so then people are out there, it becomes their neighborhood, and then you see people from other neighborhoods coming in there too.
And lastly, it seems like the mall of the present, though, has more experiences than the mall of the past, because if you're going to the mall 30 years ago, you had to walk in through Sears, you had to walk in through Marshall Fields or Carson Perry Scott, and now the big anchor stores that used to be at some of these malls, they're a laser tag. They're a place to do something or take part in some activity. It's not a place to shop anymore.
Exactly. And that's part of what's the allure, or what mall owners and developers are trying to do, is bring people in there for things like I mentioned, medical offices in malls. Now we see them, you've seen them here and there throughout Chicago, for example, but now it's becoming a thing to put that kind of thing in there, because you get people in there to, you know, get their teeth cleaned, and then they, you know, go out to an entertainment. And then with, you know, with Gen Z, and especially you look at things like entertainment, like the axe throwing, which still I don't understand, but the axe throwing and restaurants and, you know, rock climbing and such like that. You're seeing a lot of that.
Jennifer Waters, Chicago-based business reporter, thank you for joining us today. Coming up next, the changing media landscape has significantly impacted how kids consume and understand news. We'll explain.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
The media landscape has changed so much over the past decade, leading to a pressing question. Will today's kids recognize the urgency and significance of breaking news? We welcome in Tim Hanlon, founder and CEO of the Viterra Group in Chicago. Tim, thank you for joining us today. And some of these kids who have lived entirely in a digital first environment, entirely in an on-demand environment, what is going to happen when they turn 18, when they enter the prime advertising demographic, and our traditional media outlets, are they prepared to meet this new generation and their media consumption habits head on?
Yeah, certainly not, Rob. The legacy media industry, right, as we talk here in December of 2024, is very much coming to grips with this slowly but surely, and now all at once, evolution of media consumption. And news and information is absolutely at the heart of it. I mean, just to put it all in context, right, the median age of an average viewer or listener for various forms of, let's call it, classic or traditional media, cable news is 70 years old, 70. Primetime television, 65 years old. Newspapers, around 60. Talk radio, 58. Podcasts, by comparison, 34, right? And you go into TikTok and YouTube, those kinds of things, even lower ages than that. And that, frankly, really just encapsulates on a grander scale the attraction and the different forms of consumption that younger and more digitally savvy and digitally first audiences have been essentially accessing information. And that clearly, that fragmentation and that sheer shift from a smaller group of traditional linear media choices makes for a much more polyglot understanding of what's going on in the world. And the ramifications of that are, I don't know, they're playing out now, but probably more complexity because of that to come.
Yeah, it is certainly a challenge, but it's also an opportunity. I think it's a very interesting, if you're a professional in this space, to try to find a way to get a good quality, well-produced, high-level product in front of an audience that certainly is very interested in perceiving the world around itself. And right now, they want to know what's going on. They want to have events put in context. And right now, they're just simply going to the people who are in their space, and it may not necessarily be professional journalists.
Yeah, and I think that's the challenge and the reality, right? The reality is that it's simply more accessible in those environments, peer-to-peer, shared, streaming, mobile, video, TikTok, small bites, the meme-driven kinds of things. The challenge, though, is how do you evolve that information, or perhaps if that is the first line of information for these younger audiences, that those methodologies, how do you then back it up and or make it more confirmable in a more legitimate kind of way? Where else, how else do you go further with that information to corroborate it, to ensure that it's real, it's not fake and AI and all that kind of stuff? And I think that's the thing that most people in the professions of media and journalism have to figure out is how do we backstop this stuff? And I would argue it's not sitting back and relying and saying, oh, people will tune into the radio or watch the television newscast. No, it's got to be perhaps an evolution of that so that it meets these audiences where they are and it adds a level of fiber, shall we say, and confidence that this information is actually legit.
Tim Hanlon, founder and CEO of the Verter Group in Chicago, thank you for joining us today.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof like Aloe, Allbirds, or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling and for shoppers buying simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet and the not so secret secret with Shop Pay that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whenever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout experience as business powerhouses like Aloe, Allbirds, and Skims. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
Hey guys, it's Jim Costa from Cash the Ticket. If you're planning on betting college football bowl games, good luck. No, seriously, it's never been harder. And you don't want to be hurting your bankroll. You want to make sure you're doing your homework. Listen to Cash the Ticket. Mike Valeni and I will be breaking down every single bowl game, dropping new episodes nearly every day throughout college football's postseason. Spicing things up with a 12-team playoff. Can't wait to see some of those teams from the South come up north for the snow. Be sure to subscribe to Cash the Ticket on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon, I'm Rob Hart. These are the top stories on News Radio WBBM. Warming centers across the city will remain open today amid the bitter temperatures. President-elect Trump kicks off his visit to New York by ringing the opening bell at the New York Stock Exchange. Plus, it's Technology Thursday. We'll touch on how virtual reality is aiding medical students. WBBM Business. Markets are lower. The Dow is down 109 points. NASDAQ down 32. And the S&P 500 is down 11. We have 12 degrees right now in Chicago under partly sunny skies, but it feels like zero with that wind chill. It's 12:31, topping your news at the half hour. As the temperature continues to drop, the City of Chicago warming centers will be open until 5 o'clock this evening at more than 190 public facilities. This includes participating Chicago Public Libraries, the Chicago Park District, Chicago Police Departments, and the City Colleges of Chicago facilities. If you find the nearest warming center, please call 311, and you can find emergency overnight shelter at 311 as well. President-elect Trump received two honors during a return to New York.
On Wall Street, the longtime New York businessman rang the New York Stock Exchange's opening bell for the first time, pumping his fist as the crowd chanted.
Thank you very much. This is an honor.
Both ringing the bell and being named Time Magazine's Person of the Year for a second time. The first was after he first won the White House 8 years ago.
I think I like it better this time, actually.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
It's 12:32 as the noon business hour continues. Markets are lower. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Sam Stovall, Chief Investment Strategist, CFRA Research in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Sam, thank you for joining us today. A little bit of a pullback for the three major indices today. Is this a reaction to the producer price index report, or is this a little bit of a pullback in response to the NASDAQ breaking a closing record yesterday?
Hello, Rob. Good to talk to you. Actually, there's a little bit of truth in both of those scenarios.
because the producer price index, the PPI, was a little hotter than anticipated. We've seen the yield on the 10-year note rise, and typically investors would prefer lower interest rates over higher interest rates. So also because the NASDAQ eclipsed the 20,000 threshold, it's been said that large round numbers act like rusty doors and require several attempts before finally swinging open. So this could simply be a short-term resistance.
And then when we had the producer price index figures out today showing that the wholesale inflation picked up a little bit in the month of November. However, the core PPI still remained in line with expectations. What are analysts taking out of this report today?
Well, I think that they are gearing up for the PCE, the personal consumption expenditure report, at the end of the month, which happens to be the Fed's favorite inflation indicator. And unfortunately, there we're likely to see an uptick year on year for the headline as well as the core level. So it could experience a little bit of inflationary headwinds before we move into 2025.
Now, it doesn't appear that this is going to do much to knock the Fed off of its course of cutting rates by a quarter of a percentage point next week. It seems like that move has been telegraphed so much that if you want to remove that from the realm of possibility, that would spook the markets even more. So it sounds like that if Fed Chair Jay Powell, if they cut rates next week, it's going to be all eyes are going to be on the news conference where he talks about maybe fewer cuts in 2025.
Well, you're right. I think that Fed Chair Powell and the FOMC, Federal Open Markets Committee, will end up agreeing to cut interest rates by 25 basis points or one quarter of 1%. And when we move into 2025, our expectation is that the Fed will cut by 25 basis points in each of the upcoming quarters. So slowing down the pace of cuts, if you will, and at the same time, reminding investors that they remain data dependent.
And then lastly, it just seems like between the CPI yesterday and the PPI out today, it just goes to show you that that last mile in the fight against inflation is always the most frustrating to get to that 2% target.
It's almost like a marathoner who hits the wall with only a mile or two to go. You're absolutely right. And so I think it's going to take until early 2026 before we get the year-on-year percent change in core PCE to come down to that magic 2% threshold.
Sam Stovall, Chief Investment Strategist, CFRA Research in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up next in Technology Thursday, using augmented reality and virtual reality technologies to help train surgeons.
Information, the WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's Technology Thursday on the Noon Business Hour. Training surgeons using AR, augmented reality, and VR technology, virtual reality, along with advanced artificial intelligence assistance and teaching tools like Level X is revolutionizing surgical education. Joining us with the details is Matt Wren, tech expert and founder VRAR Chicago in Chicago. Matt, thank you for joining us today. And it seems like everything has to be a game today. And I'm not saying this to be snarky, because I do hear some people who say that they need to gamify everything, whether it's reading more books, drinking more water, working out more, learning how to be a surgeon. The video game approach to life is a way for a lot of people to advance in life.
Well, if you think about the psychology of it, nobody wants to sit in a classroom. Like, I don't want to be told that I have to go learn something. However, if I'm playing a game and I happen to be learning as a byproduct of playing that game, it makes it really valuable, because A, I'm not really actively, constantly just trying to learn something. I'm actually, you know, doing an action, trying to hit a high score, trying to do something that's going to be a little bit fun for me, possibly. And in doing so, I'm actually learning a new skill, learning an activity, or practicing a skill. You don't have to actually be learning a new one, like with Level X that was brought up earlier. You could just be, you know, practicing something that you already know how to do, but you're trying to get a higher score at it. You're trying to get better at it. And in doing that, you are practicing. You are doing a repetitive task that, if you just, you know, kind of focused on doing the repetition, your focus is in the wrong place. Whereas if you're focusing on kind of having fun with the experience, then ultimately you're learning as a byproduct. And the flip side of that is you're also producing a lot of analytics in terms of the performance that you're actually doing. You're able to track, because in playing a game, there is a score that's generated. There is, you know, the activity that you're doing and the analytics around that activity, and that produces a lot of data, and that data can be very valuable as well.
Now, let's break this down, the three components. We're talking about using augmented reality, virtual reality, and AI to train surgeons with Matt Wren, tech expert and founder of VRAR Chicago. The augmented reality component and the virtual reality component to surgical training, how does this differ from the traditional approach?
Sure. Well, with the traditional approach, if you think about, you're going to train a surgeon how to perform a procedure. First of all, there's a lot of time that it's going to take to set them up just to go through one repetition of that training, that procedure. In addition, there's possibly some material. So if you're, you know, if you're teaching somebody how to do something, whatever, suturing. Okay, you got to have the sutures, you got to have the needle, you got to have whatever you're doing to simulate the skin. Whereas if you're using augmented reality and virtual reality, there is no material involved, so there's a lower cost there. And additionally, there's no setup time because you can pretty much just hit a reset button. So you can get through a lot of repetitions a lot faster. That's one reason that makes it a little bit more advanced, whereas you're still able to get, you know, somewhat at least the behavioral, the actual behavioral physical training that's taking place. And in addition to that, because it's augmented reality and virtual reality, you're able to track what people are looking at, how they're moving. You're able to sort of measure how people interact with physical space that you can't really do with any other technology. And that's what makes it valuable, because all of that is also producing those analytics that are then so valuable to use for, you know, performance enhancement, running that through AI algorithms and saying, how do we make this training better in the future?
And then very quickly, Matt, we have the AI component. We have the data. How does the AI sift through that data and make you a better surgeon?
Well, it's about, so AI is very good at dealing with lots of, you know, lots of data, frankly. For humans, once you start dealing with massive, massive, massive amounts of data, it starts becoming hard for us to analyze that. Whereas AI, that's actually what makes AI thrive. The more data you have, the better it is. And on top of that, AI can deal with what's called unstructured data. Whereas, you know, instead of us having to tell it specifically what to look for, you can say, hey, listen, analyze all of this data that we're finding you and help me find patterns that are harder for me to recognize as somebody, as a human, just looking at lots and lots of data. So the AI components can ultimately find patterns and find things that might be harder for us to measure without using a tool like AI.
Matt Wren, tech expert and founder, VRAR Chicago, based in Chicago. Thank you for joining us today. Join us at this time tomorrow for Entrepreneur Friday. And still to come, Warren Buffett's portfolio could reveal insights into the market's next move.
Investing 60 minutes each weekday for planning for the future. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Warren Buffett's cash reserves and short-term holdings signal that stocks may be overvalued, suggesting a market correction and lower prices could be ahead. Welcome in Mark Hulbert, investment columnist for the Wall Street Journal, Barron's, and MarketWatch.com, based in Washington. Mark, thank you for joining us today. And before we talk about what this particular move may mean for the markets, for decades, there has been almost a genre unto itself inside business publishing of trying to get inside Warren Buffett's brain. And historically, how successful are authors at trying to pick his mind?
Well, that's a great question. I say in general, in fact, I might even go so far as to say almost universally, no one has succeeded in doing that. And in this particular case, with regard to what market timing judgment it might be that he has such a huge cash position, he's gone out of his way to say he does not believe in market timing. He's never made a decision based on any market timing judgment. So he's doing an active part in trying to discourage anyone from even trying.
But what kind of signal does, given that all those, with all those caveats in place, what kind of signal could this potentially send?
Well, yeah, I went and looked at that very question, and it turns out I do think there is some market timing information available in the huge cash position. And I think the reason that it's possible to square that with Buffett's claim that he isn't a market timer is that he's referring to short-term fluctuations in the market. And the cash position he builds up in Berkshire Hathaway, his company, does not have short-term significance. And I showed that by going back and looking through the history.
looking at its cash position year by year, going back several decades. But it turns out when you go out with a longer term horizon, you look about where the market will be in 5 or 10 years, it turns out that his cash position actually is a fairly powerful indicator. And when there's a large amount of cash, as there is today, typically the market produces lower than average returns than when he has a low cash position. So I think that suggests that at least at a minimum, trying to get inside Warren Buffett's mind, that he thinks the market's probably overvalued.
Now, at the same time, he's not alone in that belief. It seems like a lot of analysts that we've had on seem to be of the mind that maybe there's a lot of froth here, and it's just a good idea to cash out and sit back for a little while.
Well, I think that's right. But again, what I think is being added to the discussion, which, as you say, a lot of people have said, is from Warren Buffett, what's being added is it's a focus on a multi-year horizon. He's not saying the market can be lower next month or next quarter, but it probably will be in 5 years.
And also, it seems to also kind of square up with your contrarian analysis of where things were, are, and headed.
Well, that's right. So contrarian analysis is a much more short-term indicator. But as you say, I've focused many times in conversations with you that there's so much optimism out there that suggests the market is probably the path of least resistance is down. But that's, we're talking the next month or several months, not next 5 years.
Mark Hulbert, investment columnist for The Wall Street Journal, Barron's, and MarketWatch.com in Washington. Thank you for joining us today. If you missed any part of the Noon Business Hour, we'll have the replay podcast available shortly at WBBMNewsRadio.com and the Odyssey app.